Hi, my name is Nathan Cook, and you're listening to HDR Brews, in other words, High Degree Researchers Drinking Coffee. This small show is designed for academics to put their research interests in the spotlight. Please sit, learn, and enjoy a cuppa while we do too. Hello, and welcome to HDR Brews, in other words, High Degree Researchers Drinking Coffee. This episode's researcher is Lena Breek, and cup of coffee is brought to you at home. I'm actually having a decaf. I've never journeyed down the decaf road, but ever since I finished my PhD, I need to stop drinking as much as I was. So, but I have just gone to Aldi, got the standard Aldi decaf, and I actually really like it, so which has been good. What are you drinking, Lena?
I've got a super boring drink. Are you ready for it? It's water.
Great.
So I try and get through 2 liters of water a day.
Yeah.
And I'm very proud to say that that was my 2023 goal. And I'm going well. I just bought a 2 liter bottle from Amazon for my New Year's resolution last December, and it's worked.
Cool.
So I try to get, and it's got like little timings on it. So it tells me by 7 a.m. you've got to finish this much, and then 9 a.m., 11 a.m. And it's just, it's brilliant.
That's awesome.
Goals. It gives me goals. So,
I
mean, yeah.
Got the, I like sipping too. I think it's way easier to drink sipping, right? Yeah.
100%. But on the decaf, I actually switched to decaf because I do Ramadan every year, and we struggle so much from the caffeine. So then we switched to decaf after Ramadan, and I've done it also for this year. And decaf is heaven.
That's cool.
It's great. Yeah, your body fully just adjusts after 3 weeks. So give yourself 3 weeks, you'll get there.
Yeah, thank you. Because I, you know, with writing the PhD, you'd have one in the morning, have it at lunch, and then you're like, oh, well, I've got stuff to do tonight, so I'll have another one. But then you don't sleep, right? So, or some people, you know, my dad can drink whatever he wants and still fall asleep, but I'm perhaps a bit more sensitive than others. So, and I said Lena Breek, that's right. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I normally say break, just take a break, take a Kit Kat, but yeah, I know the spelling's a bit.
That's good that I'm going to use that. Yeah. So first of all, Lena, what is your area of research?
All right, so home tube feeding, but in particular, because with PhDs, apparently you have to focus in, so you've got to stay focused. I'm working on homemade blended tube feeding, which is a huge taboo in the area of home tube feedings. Especially in Australia, we still are yet to accept person-centered home tube feeding choices. So if someone wants to make their own formula or put grandma's dinner down their tube, unfortunately in Australia, 30% of healthcare organisations would actually discharge the patient.
Oh.
And so I'm looking at the fact that we need to somehow overcome this and just... Because her patients are going elsewhere. They're going to naturopaths. They're going to the internet to make up these blends. And then they're getting admitted to hospital with severe dehydration and malnutrition. Mm. And my theory is, as dietitians, we need to progress our thinking and actually implement person-centered care that we always talk about, which includes embracing homemade blended tube feeding formula. The UK have done it and the US have done it. And so that's what I'm trying to understand, the Aussie landscape of blended tube feeds.
We're a very weird and different country, Australia. You know, we're a bit behind the times. We're far away from everyone. We don't care about a lot unless it's sport. Like, it's
exactly.
If you're doing better than someone else, you're going to get called out.
I blame time zone. We're too far away from the world and we're just opposite of everybody all the time. Yeah.
Well, where you are, you know, which is very cool. So probably my first international HDR Brews guest. You're in Singapore, which is like the epicenter of the world. So, you know, you've got, if you could project it from there, you know, on down to Australia. But there's so many questions with this, you know, particularly with, you know, something like tube feeding. For those who aren't dietitians and who are listening, when you do your undergraduate dietetics, you kind of get to this stage where, you can suggest people what to eat or drink. But what if they can't eat or drink, you know, if they've got some sort of, I guess throat cancer or something like that, and people will get a tube inserted into their Which genum? Duodenum, jejunum, which one?
It's normally into the stomach. Majority of feeding tubes go straight into the stomach.
Yeah.
But for those who get stomach cancer, for example, or are in a motor vehicle accident where their stomach's not functioning well after, it goes into the jejunum. So, the second part of the small intestine.
And so from there, I think it's so important because, you know, we give ladies, you know, it's getting a lot better now, the acceptance and the need for breastfeeding. It's just like, hang on, mate, I'm just going to have my lunch. And you can still talk and I can still do whatever. I just need to pour my lunch down and be here. And it's like, well, it's no different to you going to breastfeed or going to, hey, I've got to go to the bathroom. I've got to go have my lunch. And I want to be able to do that in my own home, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You've touched on a really crucial part of home tubing. It's about 7,122-ish people who are home tube fed across Australia and New Zealand from a cross-sectional study that we did in 2021. So it might not sound like a lot, but this is a very vulnerable group of the population. And you are absolutely spot on in saying social isolation is one of their biggest issues. And you're right, there's simple things like the breastfeeding stickers that are slapped on in different cafes to say, hey, we support breastfeeding. Why can't we have a tubey sticker to say, hey, we support tube feeding? Whip out your PEG tube, your gastrostomy tube, and pour some formula down, and you won't get stared at or pitied. There was a recent media advertisement by a particular company that I won't mention, but it basically portrayed a person who was home tube feeding in a very negative manner and very like, oh, because they smoke, they've got throat cancer and now they eat through a tube. And it was just amazing to see a whole bunch of tube fed people lobby together, write an article and get that advertisement actually pulled down.
Stigma
and social isolation is a really big problem for this population. Who often have no choice but to be tube fed. They just need to find that normality-ish, I hate that word, normalness, but they need to feel included in the wider society.
Yeah, they need to feel safe and they need to feel accepted for sure.
Yes.
And that's, you know, I think, you know, society in some aspects is moving in that way to let everyone be able to do what they want to do and be, you know, you think about, you know, access for people who have disabilities in terms of wheelchair or whatever. It's like you can't build a building without a ramp. That's the rule. That's it. You know, full stop. And, you might say that, yes, it's a smaller population of Australia, but they're still people, you know, and they still want to be heard and they still need them. They're still, you know, they're a clinical population who require a high amount of care. And so we need to make sure we're providing that for them. So how did you
Every life matters.
Yes, that's right. And how did you get into this area? You know, you were obviously, we'll talk about your history in a moment, but like your whole brand or, you know, your whole background is, you know, the tube dietitian. Where did you start? You know, how did you get into tube feeding? How did that all work?
So I'm a very big advocate for rural and regional starting out there. So I finished my dietetics degree at Monash and then my first job was in a hospital in the beautiful Golden Valley Health in Shepparton in Victoria. And it was a clinical job. And so then after that, my last 12 years of my career have been in a hospital setting, just behind four walls. Once COVID hit, I just started getting really frustrated at the health system and the fact that I didn't feel I was getting satisfaction from work anymore. After 12 years of being in a hospital, I just felt exhausted and dissatisfied, and people would come into hospital and leave. I'd never hear what they've done in their life. I'd never hear if they've recovered, and that sort of really frustrated me. So when COVID hit, I started tube dietitian, my private practice, and I decided to hone in on people who have feeding tubes at home. And are actually wanting to follow their life and follow their journey in the comfort of their homes. Since I've just found so much more satisfaction in what I do for the past 3.5 years. And so I decided I think this is the space for my PhD. I mean, another really big area I'm passionate about is ICU nutrition.
Mm.
So I was tossing up between the two, home tube feeding or ICU nutrition for my PhD. But then I decided, no, I think home tube feeding isn't getting the representation it deserves. And then, yeah, on this path. So yeah, so it really stems from a passion to go into people's homes and demedicalize tube feeding.
Mm. And is there a, you know, regulation or rules about what people can do in their own home in terms of this type of stuff?
Absolutely not. Yeah. And this is the whole point of the NDIS, the National Disability Insurance Scheme, that was rolled out not too long ago, is that people with disabilities have every single choice and control opportunity that you and I do.
Mm.
And a large portion, so 83% of my clients through my private practice are under the National Disability Insurance Scheme. So it's a very large population in the disability sector. They have absolute choice and control. You want to put grandma's dinner down your tube, you can do it. And your dietitian and your doctor should be supportive in helping you do it safely rather than, a slap on the wrist to say, no, it's not evidence-based.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah. It's not, I know there's like, obviously, you think about, you know, there's no risk of aspiration, you know, from what I know, in terms of it's not going to come back up. There's no, you know, I guess, perfect recipe, right? You know, you just got to, even my, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm just like speculating, but like my nana, she had a awful reflux, and it was like, you know, you switch to puree or you switch to mince moist, and it's like, if I had the choice, I'm not sure, but like, blended food, like, it just seems like a no-brainer type of thing.
A no-brainer, yeah. If I had the choice, me too, I there's nothing against the commercial formulas. I've used them for the 12 years of my hospital career, and I've seen them do amazing things for people's recovery. They're brilliant, but people have every right to choose one over the other if that's what they wish, and they should receive the exact same amount of medical support and care. And that's that. That's what it's about. Choice and control. And putting the baton into the client's hands, not in our hands as the clinician.
And they're not a math problem, you know. They're not X amount of protein, you know, carbs and fat that you can put in a formula. And you just have that six times a day and there's your six meals with snacks or whatever. It's a lot different. Yeah. We need to talk about whole foods, fiber, vegetables, micronutrients, you know, diversity of protein source, whole grain. Yeah, all the same stuff. And so
it's all the same stuff.
What are the, perhaps like a, if you're allowed to disclose, you know, what's the most interesting recipe you've seen people blend up at home?
Oh, gosh. Alcohol? I've seen... client pop whiskey down but that's what he chose to do and that's his choice. But you're absolutely right that it's no different to what we're eating through our mouth. And when I started embracing blended homemade formula 3.5 years ago, I asked a mentor in Canada. I said to her, so but how do I nutritionally assess somebody on a homemade blend? And she said, well, how do you assess somebody eating normally? It's the same stuff.
Yeah.
It's a cup of lentils, half a cup of kale, half a cup of banana, half a cup of carrot, pop it in a blender, and there you've got your fresh veg and your protein in your feeding tube.
Mm.
Make sure it's the right consistency, and that's it.
Mm.
And it's the same concept as if you're eating through your mouth. Mm. So you're absolutely right. It's a no-brainer if someone chooses to go down that path.
Yeah. And so if they don't choose like homemade blend, does that mean they have to, you know, perhaps could you describe like a patient journey if they've been sent home with a tube, what's their next steps?
Normally they're sent home with the tube with about 7 to 14 days worth of commercial formula and equipment. They get followed up traditionally by the hospital dietitian. If they're a public patient in Australia, they get logged into the home tube feeding systems attached to each of the public hospitals. Some hospitals support. At the moment, there's been a very big shift in public hospitals supporting blended tube feeding, but majority don't. So if a client's at home and they go, actually, I don't want the commercial stuff that I was on in hospital, I'm going to try a Sunday roast down my tube. If the hospital finds out, they'll go, oh, we're going to cut supplies and we're going to cut medical care because you're now doing something we don't really support. But if the hospital supports it, they get supported with ongoing equipment. But we know, as I said, from a recent cross-sectional study that, 30% of Australian New Zealand hospitals in the public system would actually discharge a patient or limit follow-up if they find out they're on homemade blends.
That's such like a big, doesn't make it over, for me, who's not an ectopic expert versus you, it makes me frustrated. Yeah. I can't imagine what it does to your head. you must be screaming. Yeah. Obviously, why you're in this area. So
absolutely.
So you did mention you've got your private practice, and so what made you pursue a PhD? Can you talk about your research pathway, how you went from, obviously you talked about undergrad and then you've gone and done rural stuff and come back. What was the research or the decision to target or tackle some research?
Yeah, so I finished my bachelor degree at Monash like more than a decade ago. And then I love research because I love the curiosity and watching a clinical bedside question sort of unfold or snowball into a project. I love that process. And so I did an honours year after my bachelor with St. Vincent's and Monash, which was really cool. So that was for a year. And then I went off and spent 12 years in the hospital setting. Then I did a Master of Public Health because I started, as I said, getting angry at the hospital system and just wanting to sort of do a bit more, get out of those four walls and see what else is out there. So I did an MPH, and then the MPH reignited my thirst for research. So I said, okay, once I'm done with the MPH, I think I'm going to go down a PhD path. So it stems from my passion to, as I said, just watch a bedside question unravel or snowball, however you want to see it. But also I love teaching. Like, I love teaching, and I think for academia, research is crucial to be able to build sort of project design, a research project from a bedside question. It's a very tough skill. And I think it's necessary when hopefully I become an academic to actually be able to impart that. So, a love for inquisition and a love for academia is what led me to a PhD.
And so how did you come up with your own question, because this is, you're kind of the expert in Australia on this topic. Did you write a big proposal and call up Zoe, or how did that go?
Actually, that's a really good question, and I think it's important to talk about that. If you're a clinician listening, or and yes, you've got a bedside question, that was exactly my situation. My bedside question was, I wonder how people with home feeding tubes are coping. I wonder if homemade blended feeds are better or to the same standard as commercial formula. And those were my two questions that I then actually took to Zoe. And I know Zoe because I did my bachelor's degree at Monash. I think she was back then doing her PhD. So I knew her from, more than a decade ago. And I contacted her, and I knew that I work really well with her because she's the complete opposite of me. And that's what I need. I needed somebody who's not me to be my supervisor. And I contacted her and I said, look, I'm interested in a PhD and I think I'm heading down the pathway of home tube feeding. And these are sort of my two questions. What's the quality of life and how are people coping at home with a feeding tube in Australia? And number two, what's the whole blended tube feeding situation? Like, what are people doing? And she said, right, let's write a two-page research proposal and submit. And so that was really, it was two pages, and it was so easy to write because I have so much passion in the area. I was able to just write it just blah, kind of onto an empty page to say, this is the problem. We don't have an answer. This is what I think I'm going to get out of this PhD. And these are the expected outcomes to better the lives of people with home feeding tubes. And it was so unrefined, and it was a mess. And now looking back at it, I've gone, oh my God, this proposal is way too huge. Like, no one could do this in a PhD. But, you know, that's, they just need, when you submit a PhD proposal to a university, and you've got the backing of a strong academic, they just need to see that you've got the passion, you understand the clinical picture, you've got the enthusiasm and the inquisitivity, that's the word, to delve into it, and you've got the senior researcher backing you up. They don't need to see a perfect proposal, because that was definitely not.
Mm.
And that was really it.
Mm. Fantastic work, because I completely resonate with you in terms of my topic, and when I applied through Georgia and Judy, like, it was literally like a 2-page of just like, I'm built for this role and I care about it more than you know, and that got me across the line, you know. And it's like, if you don't have, if a PhD student doesn't have enthusiasm, they're going to lose interest and it's going to explode. Like, you have to love it to be able to do it. And, you know, you may do something else and I may do something else in the future, because we've now got different research skills that we build throughout that time. But when you're in your PhD, you got to love it. Like, like someone talks about a tube and you go, hey, that's me. What do you want to know?
Yeah.
Like,
your ear's got a perk.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and, like, it comes out in your presentations and it comes out in your writing. So,
yes!
No, that's really cool. Yes. I'm glad that you had that experience of, you know, putting something together and going for it, and now you're there.
The biggest ingredient for a PhD is definitely not research skill, because I've got none of that, nor is it expertise. Whilst I do have expertise in home tube feeding, but that's not what I'm utilising at the moment. The main skill I'm utilising, exactly what you said, passion, enthusiasm, diligence, excitement, that's it, for that topic.
Mm.
And I think that's why it took me a very long time in my career. I always thought I'd do a PhD from day dot, but it took me, like 13 years to finally do it, because I wanted to make sure I care about it enough to stick around.
And, you might come across 100 clinical problems in your daily job, but it's like, what's the one that you can have an influence on? Someone else can do a PhD about triage, or someone else can do a PhD about diabetic care, but it's like, that's not for you. Like,
but you know what's sad? What's sad, and it still disheartens me, is that at the end of the day, our PhDs are a drop in the ocean. but I had to accept that. Like I said to Zoe, I want to do this and I want to do that, and she's like, nah, you need to focus it in, like hone it in on a particular. It's a drop in the ocean, but it's a very important drop. But that's how the ocean starts, drop by drop. So I want to do an RCT, a randomized controlled trial. I kept telling her, I want to make up my own blend and then compare it and do an RCT. And she's like, nah, that's too big. Let's go back to baby steps. Where are we at with homemade blended tube feeding in Australia? And what can we do first to pave the way for an RCT?
Yeah, and that's right. You have all the shiny balls, the ideas, and you put them in a jar on the shelf. And when you get your PhD, you can go, which one do we want to start first? And then start taking balls out and you start putting different ones in, and then you have, you know, I've similar ideas in terms of what I want to do, and it's like, you just got to get the PhD first. Just like, you don't even have it yet. You're still doing it. You got to get it, and then you can be the boss, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you've got bosses above you, and you kind of have to, you know, work as a team to get the PhD done. But once it's done, it's like, Georgia calls it your research internship, you know, your internship, and you've been trusted to do it with eyes, and now you've been accepted to be part of us, you know, and part of academia. So with those two questions, what are you currently working on?
As in the PhD?
Yeah.
So study one was a systematic literature review, looking at the evidence, because that's the ball that we've got to start off with in Australia. So looking at the evidence in adults, so the difference between homemade blended tube feeding and commercial formula on quality of life, nutritional status, and adverse events in adults on feeding tubes.
Mm.
There's quite a bit of body of evidence in kids from the UK and the US, because kids have been doing this for a while, but in terms of the adult population, it's It's risen probably in the last 6 years in the developed world due to an increased interest in whole foods. And so I'm looking at the body of evidence comparing those two. And my literature review, it's done now, and we've submitted it hopefully to be accepted for publication. But what we found is that there's low evidence around improvement in diarrhea with homemade blended feeds. But in terms of other outcomes, like quality of life and adverse events and nutritional status, the evidence, the studies that we looked at did not use validated tools to measure those. Mm. So it's really hard when everyone's using a different marker for nutritional status. One person's using weight, the other one's using albumin levels. Very difficult to compare. No use of validated tools. We found that nutritional, out of the 8 studies we looked at, Nathan, 5 had differing, the composition of the blended feeds and the commercial formula was not equivalent.
Mm.
5 out of the 8. So how are you comparing 100% of an antibiotic with 50%?
Yeah.
How does that make sense? But that's the body of literature. One particular study, the blended feeds had 54 grams of protein and the commercial had 100. And they failed to mention that in any of their discussion. But they were very quick to conclude homemade blends are detrimental. Well, if you're feeding someone half the amount of antibiotic, of course you're not going to see the same results in the infection. Yeah, so we found, so 5 out of the 8 studies had inequivalent nutritional composition. Oh my God, one of them was looking at blended commercial on diarrhea. And guess what? They had differing fiber content. I was like, this is ridiculous. The blended feed had 5 to 10 grams of fiber per liter and the commercial had 15 to 20. How do you compare that? So this is the state of our literature.
Yeah.
So really the conclusion is we have low to very low to low evidence around the benefits or the adverse events or adverse effects of homemade blended tube feeding compared to commercial formula. We cannot conclude anything about either of them. Mm. So study 2 is what I'm working on now. And we're looking at really understanding the enablers and barriers. And actually, I've been reading one of your brilliant papers using the TDF.
Oh, okay. Yep. Yeah.
and I'll be doing a very similar tactic. So I'll be using the theoretical domains framework to develop a survey for dietitians across Australia in particular through DA. Actually, I'll be doing a 3-month internship at DA this particular study. And using the TDF, we'll be trying to understand the enablers and barriers of dietitians to provide home enteral nutrition care, home tube feeding care, and 2, to support homemade blended tube feeding.
Mm.
So we're looking at both aspects. What are your enablers and barriers to provide home tube feeding care for your clients? And what are your enablers and barriers to provide support in the homemade blended space?
Mm.
And then we'll use the TDF and then we'll use the behavior change wheel and we'll try and understand where a dietitian's at with this important area of dietetics in Australia. And then study 3, we'll be repeating the exact same thing, but with people who are home tube fed.
Mm.
So I'm hoping to really understand the provider perspective, the consumer perspective, and then maybe study 4 can be a model that we design that's inclusive of all of that to say this is probably a standard of care that we can go down for people with feeding tubes using the evidence we've gathered. So, yeah, we'll see.
That's fantastic. And I think, you know, for people who don't understand or aren't familiar with like study designs, with what you've talked about, with talking about the provider and the consumer, that's really good because the dietitian may say, well, I'm giving them all the information they need to know and I've given them the pamphlet. And then the consumer could be like, they're not telling me anything. And it's like, you don't know these things unless you ask, right?
Yeah.
You know? And is there some sort of way to design something that like the consumer can be like, have contact with their dietitian and be like, can I have this?
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to a friend's house, they're making this. Can I bring my blender and is that all right, you know, type of thing, to make sure that they can still feel like they're in control with what they're doing and not like, oh, I'm going to a party, I have to have my enteral, you know, pre-made tube mix from Abbott or whoever, you know. That's really cool. And how are you finding the TDF?
Oh, it's overwhelming, the TDF, because I don't have a psychology background. So I think the language, and because I'm very much a clinical dietitian, its language is very unfamiliar to me.
Mm.
So I really, I'm doing lots and lots of reading of how you and other people have applied it in a dietetic research setting. But yes, I'm definitely finding it overwhelming. A lot more overwhelming than I expected. I wanted it to be a math equation. This plus that, and that's a question you ask, but it's not. It's a lot deeper than that. I'm doing lots. So if you've got any breathing, let me know.
Yeah, we'll do. Yeah, it's a fun puzzle to put together. Or to take apart as well. You can you know, move it one way or the other way and map it to different stuff.
Yeah.
I find it quite fun, but also very frustrating to learn. That was the paper that took the longest out of my PhD. That took the longest.
Yeah.
Because
I can imagine.
Like you said, like learning a language. Like,
even things like belief in consequences. And I'm just like, wow, how do you explore if someone believes in the consequence of something? Yeah, it's very, very deep. I've got to leave the clinical brain completely out the window for the TDF. But it's given me a lot more confidence in the structure of my survey.
Yeah.
So that's good.
And so do you know, off the top of your head, obviously you include yourself, but you probably can't answer your own research question. Do you know many people working with, dietitians in Australia who look in this space?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm seeing, I know there's a lot in the hospital public setting, but I'm also now with the introduction of the NDIS, there's a lot of community dietitians taking on clients with disabilities, with feeding tubes. And these are community dietitians that have never worked in hospitals before, so they might not have come across such a client before. And through my private practice, I'm so fortunate, if any of them are listening to this, I've had a few of them reach out through Tube Dietitian, and we catch up for virtual coffees all the time, and I love it. Please keep contacting me, because we troubleshoot their cases together, and we talk through the clients together, and I'm definitely noticing. Yeah, the NDIS has changed the landscape. No longer is home tube feeding a hospital's job. It's definitely, the landscape's changing.
Mm.
And we've got to catch up. We've got to get our community dietitians. We've got to lift them up and give them the confidence that they can do this.
Mm.
This is a learned skill. You don't need to be in a hospital to learn how to look after someone with a feeding tube.
Yeah. And it also doesn't have to be something that you see and get scared. Like, you know,
exactly
what you're building towards is like, here's the guideline, here's the way we can do it. If your patient you've had for 20 years of private practice all of a sudden needs a tube, this is what you do. This is what you do. You don't have to discontinue care, you don't have to transfer care, you don't have to refer. You can do this. Like,
yes.
And that's, you know,
and that's majority of my conversations with these dietitians. It's, mate, you've got this. This is really not that complicated. It's similar to someone orally eating. Just make sure you've got a good network of a nurse and a doctor that you've got on speed dial for that client. And it takes a bit of digging to find, but if you keep asking, you'll get there. And if your client's in a formula, or really all the major formula companies have a nursing service directly attached to them.
Mm.
So they're normally, the nurses are the ones that look after the tube and the stoma site where the tube goes in, and you're looking after the stuff that goes into the tube. Easy. Mm. Set yourself up for success by asking those. Like whenever I get a handover from the hospital, my first question is, who's the GP or who's the specialist? Because I'm not taking this client unless there's a doctor I can speed dial. That's it.
Right. Yeah.
I don't know how to put in a tube.
No.
After my 13 years of being in a hospital, I'm not going to touch a feeding tube.
Yeah.
But my first question back to the hospital referring clinician is there an outreach service that the hospital will be supporting this client for tube care? Is there a doctor? Is there a specialist? Is there a nurse? Because, by the way, I'm doing the formula or the blended tube feed support. I'm not doing the actual tube support.
Mm. And that's like, but
don't be afraid. Yeah.
That's a really big part of, like, you know, in terms of scope as well. You know, it's like you don't want to take on stuff that you don't want to be that person who's impacted someone the wrong way by trying to provide care and then end up ruining that relationship with that person or patient.
Absolutely.
So now I'm mindful of time. You've spoken about, I guess, the trajectory of your PhD in terms of like what's next, which is really good. So we've kind of covered on that, but you are doing it part time. So I just wanted to quickly explore like how you're finding that, like the timeline and, you know, looking into the horizon, how that feels.
Yeah, part-time is actually very hard to maintain momentum as opposed to full-time. I started off full-time, but with a toddler and a private practice that I'm managing partly from overseas, full-time was just killing me. Mm. So since switching to part-time, I definitely find I'm able to catch up a lot quicker. But hopefully once I'm back on shore in Australia in the next 8 months for good, I'll be switching to full-time again. Mm. Because yes, I'm like a hamster. I really want to finish. And at the moment I'm at a good pace because I've got a toddler and a private practice, but when I'm back in Australia, I'll be switching to full-time. Mm. Nonetheless, part-time is really forgiving. I'm still pretty working at a similar speed to I would have if I was full-time. It's just the pressure of deadlines isn't there.
Yeah.
So it's actually really forgiving. So any mums listening or any clinicians listening that don't see themselves fully dropping their jobs, part-time is still very rewarding and possible and manageable. Yeah.
I think that's really important to say in terms of the pressure point because, you know, the way that we view, you know, particularly if you're, I'm similar to your hamster, I want to get to the finish, I want to see the outcome. And it's like, you got that pressure of being at the top speed. But it's like, if you can just say, hey, I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to slow down a bit. I still want to get the same stuff done, but I'm just going to take it in the pace that's more manageable. That pressure on the shoulder is going to release and you're going to be like, great, I can do this, you know. And you can do it and you're going to get there because, you know, I've done it and I've gotten there. So it is done. The light is there. It's just experiencing it and, you know, you don't want to rush a PhD either because you only do one. You know, some people do more than one, but I'm not going to do another one.
No, you're done, yeah?
Yeah. And so I'd like you to tell us, Lena, about, you know, a favourite paper of yours, either that you've, you know, written or contributed to, and then also something for the listeners to read. Wink, wink.
You know what? You told me to prepare this. And it's outside in the living area, but it's actually a recent paper on fiber. Yeah. Fiber, does it have to be nutrition related?
No, it can be anything.
Oh, okay. Well, mine's nutrition related. It's a recent article I read because fiber is a topic that baffles me. Is it soluble? Is it insoluble? Does it make your stool thicker? Does it give you diarrhea or constipation? Even after all these years of clinical practice, I still get stressed about fiber. But there's this particular paper by David So, and it is called, I've recently posted it on my socials, and why is my mouse acting? But the key thing with this paper is he basically broke it down very simply with what is the difference in the different type of fibers out there, where they act in the digestive system. Well, he revised the evidence. This is a paper literally published 2 years ago, revised all the evidence around dietary fibers and irritable bowel syndrome. And it's just brilliantly written with some beautiful figures of the gut. If you want me to read something, just draw the gut and I will read it. The paper's called Dietary Fibers and IBS, Translating Functional Characteristics to Clinical Value in the Area of Personalized Medicine. Daniel So. Is the first author. Have a look at that paper. I think my main takeaway from it that I really liked is the concept of split nutrition, so bolus nutrition, interval nutrition, whatever you want to call it. And in his case, interval fiber is actually better for the digestive system than continuous, right? And then we know that from a protein perspective. We know in the elderly, interval protein intake is better for muscle mass building, as opposed to having a massive protein meal, break it up during the day, and it's the same for fiber. That's really positive for people who have small appetites after surgery, or people on feeding tubes who can only tolerate small boluses. So it tells you you can achieve health in any way.
Yeah, you don't just go smash six scoops of Metamucil and be like, I'm done for the day. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And Metamucil is great, by the way, but I'll leave you to read the paper because it's based on psyllium fibers, and it's that's often the best fiber.
Cool.
So that's another learning from this paper. But yeah.
And so you've recently become a different type of author. Could you please explain your experience in this last couple of minutes? We've got, you know, writing and publishing a book, and it's on Amazon and everything. So it's very cool.
Yes.
And you got a hard copy in your hands for those who can't see.
Know.
Yeah.
It just arrived like last week. It was crazy. It's awesome. My book's called Your Tube, A Guide to Nutrition Through a Feeding Tube. And yes, it's on all the Amazon platforms, Booktopia, Barnes & Noble. It's a guide for people with feeding tubes. But if you're a clinician that has never worked with someone with a feeding tube, often reading consumer material is the best place to start. So in it, the book really puts the power and control back in the client's hand. My experience working with people with feeding tubes is they leave hospital and think they have to stay on the same regimen and the same formula for the rest of their life. But chapter one is exploring the abundance of options. You with a feeding tube can change the formula. You can change the regimen. You can even change your tube type. You can even change the type of equipment you're using. There's some really funky arms out there that can hold your syringe as you feed.
Oh, wow.
So the purpose of this book is to really put the knowledge that we clinicians are taught in university into the consumer's hand and to tell them, you need to know this information so that you can then go to your care team and say, hey, I want this. How do I get to this? Mm. I've got examples here of, you know, clients who, one client loves bushwalking, and he just said to me, I just want to be able to go back to bushwalking with my feeding tube. How do I do this? And we have to really come up with a regimen that's providing enough hydration and nutrition to get him through a four-hour hike in the context of half of his stomach being removed after cancer.
Mm.
So, but it's possible. So it's a really cute small book. And my most proud moment about it is Dr. Dinesh Palipada. I'm not sure if you know him. He's big in Australia in the disability space. He's a leading advocate. He's an emergency doctor who had a car accident when he was going through med school. And he's become the second paraplegic doctor in Queensland, actually, to be working in an emergency department. He's really inspiring. And he wrote the foreword for my book, which is really cool. So that was awesome to have him sort of write a brilliant foreword around, you know, embracing your individuality with a feeding tube, embracing your diet, your difference, embracing your control and choice and spirituality. And all of that's possible. It's, you know, food is a part of all of our social interactions. It's our culture. It's often love. And the essence of that doesn't change even if it's going through a feeding tube.
Mm.
I'm super excited by it, and it was so much easier to write than a scientific manuscript.
That's right. Yeah.
Much easier.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I mean, it did take me like 11 months, but it's written in the way I speak, and it has been professionally copy edited and typeset and all that sort of stuff, but it still has me, whereas a scientific manuscript doesn't always.
That's right. No,
it's often too politically correct.
Yeah,
for my liking.
I agree. Now that's fantastic. I can see that being given out to patients who, you know, they're sitting into their in the waiting room. Yep, you're gonna have your tube. Cool. and then when you come back out, here's your tube. Here's your tube book. There you go. Read this at home. Like, make sure you take it everywhere with you. Read it twice if you need to.
Yeah.
Contact Lena if you want. Type of thing.
Yeah.
It should be there. Just on the. It should be 100 copies in the drawer at every hospital.
Right. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah,
Congratulations on that.
Yeah, thank you. Today's publication date, which means anybody who's pre-ordered, the orders are released today. So I'm so excited to hear people's feedback. I've already, gone crap. I totally forgot to add a chapter on sports. But that will be edition two. Edition two, I will feature a client who has run a 10K run with a feeding tube.
Wow.
And she's amazing. So next edition, I will feature her and make sure there's a chapter on you can do sports with a feeding tube.
That's so cool. I really, as a runner, yeah. I resonate with that. That's so cool.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Now, thanks for coming on this afternoon, this morning, Lena. I really do appreciate you making some time for me to discuss your work. It's fascinating. It's so cool. How was your
Thank
water
you so much
out?
For having me.
You're right. How was your Singaporean water out of 10?
Oh, definitely 10 out of 10. It tastes very similar to Melbourne, and Melbourne is home. So
yeah. 10 out of 10. And it's 1 o'clock here, and it's 11 o'clock. Where you are, and you can already see that you're past your halfway. So that's a good...
I think so, yeah. I'm already at 3 p.m. So
yeah. Smashing it. All the talking's helping you sip more, so that's good. Sometimes I get to the end and people haven't even had one sip of their coffee because they've been chatting so much, so... To finish off, as always, thanks for listening. I really do appreciate it, as this is a passion of mine. Don't forget to leave a review, it helps other people find the show, and please share this episode on your social media or tell a friend to continue spreading the message of the Cooks community. You can sign up to our weekly email by clicking the link in the description of this episode, and follow us on our Instagram and Facebook at the Cooks community. Until next time, remember to breathe.